Okay, good evening. My name is Martin Loughlin. I'm from the Law Department, and it's my pleasure this evening to chair this evening's proceedings. This is the last in a series of lectures held over the course of this term on the topic of the rule of law, and this has been organised jointly by the LSE's Law Department in conjunction with Clifford Chance and Justice. We end this series of lectures this evening with a topic that could scarcely be more pressing, the question of how we reconcile our right to security with the claims of liberty, I mean liberty with a small l. And this, of course, has been a vital question in the light of the swathe of anti-terrorism legislation that has been enacted since 2000. We could scarcely ask for more engaged and engaging speakers on this pressing subject than the two presentations we're going to hear this evening. Shami Chakrabarty is Director of Liberty, this evening's principal speaker, and Sir Sidney Kentridge has a lifetime of experience in dealing with these questions. But permit me first to move on directly to introduce Shami Chakrabarty. Shami became Director of Liberty in September 2003, having originally joined Liberty in 2001 as in-house counsel. When I tell you, I scarcely can believe it to be true, and I haven't checked it with her, when I tell you that she joined Liberty on the 10th of September 2001, I think I hardly say no more about the scale of the work that she's had to engage with since then. She has taken Liberty through one of what must be its most challenging periods in its 70 or more years of existence. And she's become both an acknowledged expert on the UK's anti-terrorism laws as well as a vociferous critic of much of the government's anti-terrorist legislation. Her public profile could scarcely be higher. As my colleague Conor Geardy says, when I want to find out what Shami feels about a topic, I don't bother to phone her, I just switch on the radio or the TV. In December 2005, Radio 4 ran a poll of listeners to establish who ran Britain. A strange sort of exercise, one might think. Even more strange is that Shami Chakrabarty was on the short list of 10 amongst the listeners who thought of the group who may run Britain. Her achievements, of course, owe everything to one single fact, often neglected, that is, that she is a rather distinguished graduate of this institution. After graduating from the Law Department, Shami qualified at the bar before joining the Home Office as a legal advisor, and she worked in the Home Office until joining Liberty in 2001. I don't know if the Terrorism Act 2000 was one of Shami's many bills that she worked on during her period there, but if it was, it would appear to be a classic case of gamekeeper turned poacher. We are delighted to welcome Shami back to the LSE and have her address us this evening. Shami.
Very kindly put a box here for me. I might take this away with me, actually. It might be quite useful.
I have a stand right behind you.
I know. I'm sorry about that. I'm going to keep this short and to the point because it's all been said before by far more eloquent people than me. And our words have no impact upon you. Therefore, I'm going to talk to you in a language that you understand. Our words are dead until we give them life with our blood. I and thousands like me are forsaking everything for what we believe. our driving motivation doesn't come from tangible commodities that this world has to offer. Your democratically elected governments continuously perpetrate atrocities against my people all over the world. And your support of them makes you directly responsible, just as I am directly responsible for protecting and avenging my Muslim brothers and sisters. Until we feel security, you will be our targets, and until you stop the bombing, gassing, imprisonment and torture of my people, we will not stop this fight. We are at war, and I am a soldier. Now you too will taste the reality of the situation. These words are even more chilling to read aloud than they were to hear as spoken by the 30-year-old Yorkshireman Mohammed Sadiq Khan. Spoken and, it would seem, deliberately recorded some time in advance of his suicide and murder of six innocents in the Edgware Road Circle Line bombing last summer. But what is our answer? What has it been up to now, and what should it be? What is the appropriate and effective philosophical, operational and social response to Khan's grandiose prayer before death? Surely this question cuts to the heart of the nature of modern democracy, society and perhaps the essence of humanity itself. Now, I don't rehearse the diatribe to shock, and certainly not to use a now fashionable term to glorify the murderous suicide bomber, but in an attempt to ground a discussion of core principle within the reality of a current threat. And that's something that politicians perennially accuse human rights campaigners of failing to do. My concern is of how we learn the lessons of the past whilst also being informed by new and developing threats to our lives and way of life. Now, others will no doubt devote many years to studying the words and experiences of Qutb and bin Laden and the geopolitical twists and turns that made them possible or perhaps inevitable, and there may be value in that work. But I'm wary of the ease with which we become mesmerised by these distant, demonic, almost Bond-style villains, however charismatic. Their role in our consciousness, it seems to me, both terrifies and lets us off the hook. If the threat is essentially from faraway megalomaniacs with some bizarre power of remote control over dark-skinned suicidal clones here in the United Kingdom, the prescription seems all too simple. Exceptional times call for exceptional measures. Militarism abroad, martial law at home, until the arch-villain and his entire global network have been extinguished. As individuals, we need do little more than appreciate real danger and sign on the dotted line. We must give a blank check to government and others charged with our security. Surely they must be unfettered by the normal constraints of our rights, freedoms, and the rule of law at such a moment. This is the time for men of action, not ideas. Let them get on with the job of destroying those who simply hate us, in the hope that at some point in the future they will hand our open society back to us, little bruised, little battered, but essentially still intact. Now, my problem is not simply that I fear this antidote. Of course I do. But I see the threat itself somewhat differently. I don't look to faraway places and global masterminds, but closer to home, to the actions and motivations of Britons of my own generation. Now, I'm neither a theological scholar nor a psychologist, but please forgive some rather crude and lay observations about Khan's statement. Firstly, like many men throughout, young men, I suppose one could say women too, but let's just say young men for the moment, throughout history and the world, he believes he's found a cause greater than himself, and he's now prepared or determined to give his life in its pursuit. He's found an ideological or spiritual inspiration above and beyond more common tawdry concerns, the tangible commodities that this world has to offer. But he feels an emotional as well as an ideological connection to his Muslim brothers and sisters. He has found a people, a we, that's distinct and separate from his family, town, and country. Yet he doesn't speak like a radical cleric or a clone. despite the obvious illogic of punishing innocent Britons for the suffering of others around the world, he attempts to plead injustice and ill-treatment by our own democratic standards, rather than his ideological superiority. Ironically, therefore, both in his comments about bombing, gassing, imprisonment and torture, and in his all-too-predictable I am a soldier flourish, he does actually speak to us in a language that we understand. He takes both the Doug's repugnance at gassing and torture and so on, and the hawkish war on terror metaphor of Bush and Blair administrations and throws them back in our faces. Once we get past an understandable revulsion at attempting even to consider Khan's remarks, it's easy to dismiss them as any real illumination of what makes him tick. Probably didn't write them himself. Obviously, they're designed to push our buttons, and perhaps more importantly, those of a next wave of potential recruits. But that, in a sense, is the whole point. In order to thrive, this latest totalitarian challenge, like others before it, must develop at an ideological and social as well as an operational level. And accordingly, it seems to me that the response must be on all three levels as well. Now, in Britain at least, we should be capable of learning from past failings in anti-terror strategy and wary of seeing new threats as entirely similar to or different from those of the past. Northern Irish paramilitaries were not all gentlemen, nor intellectuals, nor monsters. Equally, it's as foolish as it is racist to over or underestimate all those who fall into the new extremism as completely insane. The past, I think, should warn of the dangerous counterproductivity of repression and injustice. It should also warn of the unintended consequences of overbroad repressive measures, way beyond the duration and extent of a terror threat. However, it's also vital that those who seek to defend rights and freedoms should never fall into the trap of predicating their argument upon a non-existent or exaggerated threat. If our values are truly fundamental and enduring, they have to be relevant, whatever the level of threat. Further, and understandably, the business of intelligence, whatever its inevitable weaknesses, is the prerogative of governments and not their critics. We should, I think, be sceptical, both of those who seem to promise the risk-free society and of those who pretend it's already here. We should remember that the foundations of liberal democracy are not, as some populist politicians would paint them, vague, noble, but somehow naive and open-ended notions of limitless tolerance to the point of moral relativism. Modern ideas of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law are not, as the Prime Minister's speechwriters would suggest, heirlooms of the permissive 1960s or distant 19th century. Of course, all of those who came before us played their part, but in truth, I think that if we owe our modern notions of liberal society and democratic world to any one generation, it's to those who lived through the Holocaust and the Blitz and designed the best framework possible for the avoidance of further such terrors. Many totalitarians have confused our open liberal society with one devoid of all ideological or moral content. It's an easy enough mistake to make, and one which many authoritarians and even some of the more liberal-minded amongst us sometimes help to perpetuate. All true democrats believe in liberty, equality, justice, the ultimate dignity and worth of every human being. It's all too easy to caricature this as weakness or even decadence from within or outside our society. It's so easy to blame crime, for example, on our system of justice, or truancy on a lack of corporal punishment at home or at school. It's even easier, it seems, to blame every single societal ill on the various flows of migration that marked the end of empire. Surely, if unwittingly, every time one of our politicians or other public figures denigrates progressive post-war values, they play a little more into the hands of those who think that we believe nothing, that ours is an amoral society in inevitable decline. It's seems to me, therefore, that if we are to meet a significant threat on ideological, operational and social levels, it's not enough to establish that we're against suicide bombing or dictatorship or religious fundamentalism, save in its more palatable Western forms. It's time to rediscover what we actually believe and why. What is the code that we live by? What is our answer to Sadiq Khan's diatribe? What is our entry in the competition of ideas capable of inspiring the young? What, to use a now notorious phrase, are the rules of the game that some are so keen on changing? It seems to me that the philosophy of post-war Democrats is that of fundamental rights, freedoms, and the rule of law. This is the legacy of Eleanor Roosevelt, and yes, of Winston Churchill here in the United Kingdom, one of the greatest proponents of the European Convention on Human Rights, now contained in our Human Rights Act. Shame on any young conservative who makes the convenient choice of forgetting this. Shame also on new Labour politicians who behave as if our rights and freedoms were theirs to give and take away. In this philosophy, democracy is more than simple majority rule. The rule of law, and in particular a small but vital bundle, non-negotiable rights and freedoms protect individual human beings and groups thereof from each other, and a majority that might otherwise descend into a mob. In the final analysis, by protecting free elections and speech, privacy, fair trials and so on, these rights and freedoms protect democratic society itself, for its respect for these rights, which distinguishes Democrats from dictators. Our current batch of democratic politicians should, in my view, cherish that distinction rather more than they sometimes appear to do. I think also that it's highly arguable that if any really valuable and universal notion of terrorism is ever to be achieved, it must target not all those who take up arms against a state, however oppressive, but those who abandon the human rights ethical framework in the process by, for example, indulging in inhuman and degrading treatment or torture. Ultimately, just as there can be no enduring free markets without some regulation of the associated business dealings, enforceable criminal and contract law as a bare minimum, without fundamental rights and freedoms, democracy is at best transient and at worst completely illusory. But what are some of these rights and freedoms, and how, apart from providing the democratic framework, do they guide appropriate responses to threats such as those posed from terrorism? Article 2 of the European Convention protects the all-important right to life. In convention terms, it is the ultimate reflection of the crucial human rights value in the sanctity of each individual life. It is perhaps the mirror image of utilitarian creeds in which individual life is cheap in furtherance of the greater good and where, as in Mohammed Sadiq Khan's statement, the ends justify the means. Crucially, therefore, the development of this provision by the Strasbourg Human Rights Court has required more than mere restraint from signatory states. It binds them with a positive obligation to protect the lives of people, not just their own citizens, within their jurisdiction. In the wake of the London bombings last summer, senior police officers and government ministers were quick and right to cite this provision repeatedly. Sadly, they rarely seem to read much further. It also requires the highest standards by way of independent investigation and adjudication whenever someone dies at the hands of or in the care of the state. Interestingly, this right, like most of the others, is not absolute. Unsurprisingly, in the light of its genesis, this is not a pacifist doctrine. Deprivation of life doesn't breach the right in a narrow set of circumstances where the force used is no more than absolutely necessary. Further, derogation or special exception is permitted in relation to lawful acts of war. Now, absolute necessity is, of course, the principle relevant to the use of lethal force in the context of suspected suicide bombers. It's against this stringent standard that those holding and directing police firearms must be scrutinised. It's this principle that must guide those attempting to cut through the spin and cover-up in investigating the death of Jean-Charles Menezes. Are internal police instructions and manuals adequate in this regard? How adequate was the relevant intelligence and surveillance operation? What safeguards are in place to lessen the risk of fatal error? How adequate is and was the relevant operational chain of command? As is so often the case, the Convention provides neither magic solutions nor unreasonable straitjackets for those charged with safeguarding the public interest. It does, however, provide an appropriately rigorous framework for the scrutiny of the use of power at legislative, policy, and operational levels. Article 3 contains the injunction: no one shall be subjected to torture or to inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. It enjoys special status as one of the very few absolutes in the Convention framework, contains no qualifications or exceptions whatsoever. Even the doctrine of derogation or special exception or opt-out in time of war, public emergency threatening the life of the nation does not apply. Now, in a philosophy of so few absolutes, I think it's worth pondering this one a little. Why is the intentional ending of another human life sometimes permissible, but torture never, even in the hackneyed and infamous ticking bomb scenario? In the light of the Convention's historical context, it takes little imagination, I think, to understand why those who had seen fresh images of concentration and death camps, heard testimony from Japanese prisoners of war, might find particular abhorrence in acts of torture and inhuman and degrading treatment. A further clue, perhaps, lies in the choice of the word inhuman, a suggestion that some acts of cruelty cross a line beyond which they debase perpetrator, victim, and wider society, even to the point of robbing us of some of that which makes us human. In truth, we will all die one day and aspire to a range of quick, painless, and dignified ends. Some of us even seek autonomy over the manner and moment of our death, at least in preference to lingering pain and suffering. Others find human existence so mystically precious that they believe, whatever the temptations, one should not seek to choose even the moment of one's own death. Most of us, however, can imagine last resort scenarios where we might justify taking life in self-defense or the defense of others. To take human life, whether in war or other scenario, is rightly the gravest rational choice imaginable. It means to choose the moment of another's death, in a sense quite literally to play God. But when we subject another to torture or to inhuman or degrading treatment, we play a somewhat darker role: torturer, tormentor. The political or legal system or society that directs or permits this action is the very heart of darkness that Churchill's generation was seeking to avoid. So the rule against torture is an absolute, even in wartime. This is reflected not simply in our Human Rights Convention, but a range of constitutional and international instruments reflecting the same ideals around the globe. Very simply, it is inconvenience or article of faith, depending on your point of view, depending on your belief or not in fundamental rights and freedoms. In any event, it has relevance to several questions of responding to present and future threats. Firstly, as part of an international anti-terror response, is it sometimes permissible to receive intelligence that may have been obtained by torture and place it in evidence before a British court concerned with the liberty of a suspect or accused person? Now, our highest court decided this issue at the end of last year, and I must agree, if we truly believe in the absolute nature of the rule against torture, we simply cannot feed a justice system or find someone a terrorist or remove his liberty for any significant period of time with the fruits of this poison tree. Is material gained by torture reliable? As someone with a relatively low pain threshold couldn't even have a child without a great deal of pharmaceutical assistance, I would say no. Others say that it can sometimes be, which I think is a strange answer to the charge of unreliability. Ultimately, though, It's hard to see how democratic governments can plead this case against torture, whether perpetrated by terrorists or dictators, if they indulge in the complicity of reliance upon its product. The challenge often put in retort is whether one simply closes one's ears and mind to all intelligence from dubious sources, or indeed from all non-democratic governments. My answer is this. If I were, and I know it's hard to believe, a Prime Minister or Home Secretary or Chief Constable who receives a phone call warning of an imminent attack, I would take proportionate preventative action first and ask difficult questions later. However, it is one thing to evacuate part of a city or even to arrest a suspect on intelligence from unscrupulous sources. It is quite another thing to build significant and enduring decisions about life and liberty upon possible torture. Whatever the rights and wrongs of recent foreign policy, recent events and even comments by Dame Eliza Manningham Buller should have reminded us of the vital distinction between secret intelligence and proper evidence. Both have a role in a democracy, and sometimes secret intelligence may be hardened into evidence. The only reason why the House of Lords Appellate Committee had to venture into the murky waters of material gained by torture is that government had sought in recent years to build a parallel system of quasi-justice on secret intelligence and suspicion rather than charges, evidence and proof. Now, this is not so much the battering of the criminal justice system that the Prime Minister boasted of in his last party conference speech, but the complete circumvention of it. In the longer term, this continual blurring of traditional constitutional distinctions, a recurring theme of the past 8 years, whilst producing short-term fixes for the politician of the moment, should cause both intelligence and legal communities equal concern. Overburdening intelligence and circumventing or bending justice presents serious risks to the long-term integrity of both systems. The next aspect of undermining the absolute prohibition on torture lies in the question of deportation. For nearly a decade, the Strasbourg court has maintained that a signatory state subjects someone to torture by sending him to another jurisdiction where he faces that real risk. This, in my view, is an obvious extrapolation of both the absolute prohibition in Article 3 and the principle that human rights are not just for your own citizens, but for all human beings. Now, our government would like to deport some people within its broad discretion to deal with those foreign nationals who are non-conducive to the public good. The problem arises where there is a significant risk that such a person might be tortured if returned home. This, of course, is the conundrum that resulted in the now long discredited policy, in Britain at least, of detaining such people indefinitely without trial. The latest approach is two-pronged and strangely contradictory. On the one hand, the government is negotiating so-called memoranda of understanding, bilateral agreements with countries whose record on torture might make it difficult for domestic or international courts to stomach deportation. The agreements will contain assurances from the countries concerned that they will not mistreat this individual if returned under such an arrangement. The assurance is designed to persuade a court that notwithstanding a country's repeated breaches of multilateral international human rights instruments, this individual will not be tortured or killed. Can such a specific assurance be believed in the face of countervailing evidence of past and continued bad practice? Presumably, this is ultimately a matter of case-by-case analysis for the courts. However, our government itself seems to lack sufficient faith in these assurances to leave the question of their credibility to the independent judiciary in London or Strasbourg. At the same time as negotiating these documents, therefore, the government is pursuing a legal strategy of attempting to overturn the absolute nature of Article 3 protection in deportation cases. The argument, as I understand it, is that the risk of torture to the suspect must be balanced against the risk that he is said to pose to public safety. The absolute right becomes qualified. Now, I can only see three ways in which such an argument can be advanced. Firstly, This fundamental and universal right only extends to a state's own citizens. This type of analysis was, of course, advanced by the Attorney General and roundly rejected by the House of Lords in 2004. It's the Belmarsh argument. Secondly, another alternative, a state is somehow not quite responsible for torture that happens after it sends someone, whatever the anticipated risk, beyond its jurisdiction. The see no evil argument. Or thirdly, the rule against torture is not as absolute as it appears and can somehow be trumped by national security concerns, the honest argument. Any of these arguments, if successful, could be used to legitimise the practice of extreme rendition, which has been adopted by our closest ally, the United States. All of these arguments completely undermine positive notions of seeking to wipe out torture from the face of the earth. The third approach would open up the way for some of the torture-light arguments conducted in the United States after September the 11th to be entertained here in the United Kingdom and elsewhere. In reality, all three arguments are variations on a theme of diluting Article 3's absolute protection and sending the according signals to dictators, terrorists, and their sympathisers around the globe. Articles 5 and 6 of the Convention, respectively, protect us from arbitrary detention and provide the right to a fair trial, including the presumption of innocence in the context of criminal charges. On the government's own contention, Article 5 was breached by the Belmarsh internment policy. That's why it attempted a derogation, which was eventually found wanting by the House of Lords. In the words of the Council of Europe's Human Rights Commissioner, at least some of the new anti-terror control orders made under last year's Prevention of Terrorism Act, you've got to keep track of all these bits of legislation, last year's Anti-Terror Act, these orders are likely to breach Article 6. And that's not surprising, as they amount to quite significant interferences with liberty without charge or trial. The latest attack upon our traditional ideas of due process comes in the form of a policy contained in the government's new terrorism bill, but born of a press release from the Association of Chief Police Officers, ACPO, in the wake of the July bombings. And we were all rightly scared and very dependent on the police. The government sought to extend the period of pre-charge detention for terror suspects from 14 to 90 days, the limit being just 4 days in any other criminal case, however complex. By contrast, Article 5 demands prompt information, the reasons of your arrest and any charges against you. As Lord Steyne remarked as part of the BBC's Panorama programme on the subject last year, it is hard to imagine periods of more than the present 14 days constituting a prompt charge. Lord Lloyd, another former law lord, rightly described the policy as yet another form of internment. Now, whilst the ensuing parliamentary auction of our liberties resulted in a compromise figure of 28 days, the Chancellor, Prime Minister in waiting, has openly mooted revisiting 90 days in due course. The profound fear, of course, is that this new mutation of internment, like previous versions, will be disastrously counterproductive to each of the ideological, social, and operational counter-terror efforts. You have to imagine, not those eventually charged with terror-related offences, they will be detained for several months pending trial in any event. Instead, imagine those released after 89 or 90 days. They return home, quite possibly to areas with a high proportion of British Muslims, having served the equivalent of a 6-month custodial prison sentence without ever having been charged with anything. Members of extremist groups, quite possibly now underground groups, as the government also seeks to ban extreme non-violent organisations, have been visiting the detainee's family during his absence. The extremists say that they've been protecting the family from the press and vigilantes during this extended period. Ultimately, so-called British justice is denigrated as a discriminatory sham. It is contrasted with the comforting protection of one's own people. If one reflects on the Northern Irish experience for more than a few seconds, it is very difficult, I suggest, to imagine how this policy can possibly prevent more terrorists than it recruits. Even where people are not actually recruited into extreme or violent groups, it's unlikely that they will have much appetite for reporting genuine suspicions to the police, much less joining police and security services in anything like the numbers that they should during the years ahead. Ultimately, it is more and better intelligence, not more and worse laws, that helps to deliver a country like Britain and its people from the present threat. Article 10 of the Convention guarantees the right to freedom of expression. Like many others, privacy and so on, it is a qualified or balanced right which may be subject to restrictions that are necessary and proportionate, for example, to the interests of national security, and prescribed by law. It is nonetheless the very oxygen of democratic society, and restrictions should be approached with according grave caution. In another move reminiscent of the Northern Irish experience, the new terrorism bill attempts to address the threat by curtailing speech. Its original draft contained a speech offence glorifying, exalting or celebrating terrorism so broad that it came with a 20-year watershed, requiring the Home Secretary of the day to decide which earlier acts of politically motivated crime around the world should count as terrorism rather than freedom fighting. Now, mercifully, that provision was scrapped as a discrete offence. However, the broad and vague concept of glorification was, until recent House of Lords intervention, collapsed into the remaining speech offence, this remains, of encouraging terrorism. Most importantly, and in direct contrast with traditional offences of incitement, you can commit this offence, which attracts a 7-year maximum sentence, without intending that anyone should be encouraged into acts of terrorism. It is sufficient that you were reckless as to whether some members of the public are likely to understand your words as encouragement, whether they are in fact encouraged or not. This is an offence of loose or reckless talk, which would permit those who have or would have been criticised in the past for, say, expressing some level of sympathy with Palestinian suicide bombers or their families, potentially to face prosecution in the future. Classic political arguments about the circumstances in which taking up arms against a state is justified could land participants in jeopardy. It's important to remember that the relevant definition of terrorism is incredibly broad, covering politically motivated threats and crimes against property and personnel of non-democratic governments around the world. It may no longer be lawful to express the view, for example, that the Zimbabwean people will only enjoy democracy after the overthrow of Robert Mugabe. Musing upon how many lives might have been saved by a timely assassination of Saddam Hussein might reasonably be seen as possible encouragement to terrorism in the face of other dictators. The draft law is plainly dangerous, but in the deft hands of the DPP, how might it help the anti-terror effort? Incitement to murder has long been an offence of the common law, and in 2000, on a bill that I didn't work on, not guilty to that one, guilty to many other counts, but not that one, the government created a specific statutory offence of inciting terrorism. Deliberate intention on the part of the speaker is quite properly required by these offences. And it seems that avoiding this vital component was, in fact, a major factor in the design of the new measures. This is quite unacceptable. It is likely that the new offence would constitute both a disproportionate interference with free speech and one that is not sufficiently narrowly defined to be in accordance with law. Once more, the danger is not merely of the long-term constitutional consequences of an overbroad speech offence, but of significant counterproductivity in the face of the current threat. Banning unpopular, distasteful, or even offensive speech in the current context risks criminalising hundreds and thousands of people. Instead of isolating the terrorists and their supporters, the government will place many currently law-abiding people upon the other side of the line, on the basis of their views rather than their actions. At a time when there is greatest need to openly take on the political discourse, this proposal will drive it underground, out of cross-cultural public meetings like this one, into colleges, out of colleges, into mosques, out of mosques, and into living rooms and other private spaces where it may fester unchallenged. Finally, Article 15 of the Convention is important to the present discussion, not least because it provided the standard applied by the law lords in the Belmarsh case. Those who find our Human Rights Convention of little relevance in dangerous times should reflect on the drafter's decision to provide a safety valve or derogation or special exception provision for possible use in moments of greatest national peril. In time of war or other public emergency threatening the life of the nation, special exception is permitted from most of the convention rights to the extent strictly required by the exigencies of the situation. The duality of the test for derogation is important. In a society founded upon the rule of law, the test of strict necessity rightly guides those who govern, even and perhaps especially at the moment of greatest national crisis. But when does that moment arise? Since the Belmarsh decision of 2004, and subsequently since the atrocity of last July, there has been much political scoffing at the one law lord, Lord Hoffman, who found that the public emergency limb of the derogation test had not been met by the then current threat. In a now historic passage of his speech, Lord Hoffman remarked of the policy of interning foreign national suspects that the real threat to the life of the nation comes not from terrorism, but from laws such as these. It's pretty high talk. Not from terrorism, but from laws such as these. That is the threat. On August the 4th of last year, in a now historic press conference, the rules of the game, etc., the Prime Minister publicly and confidently doubted that those words would be spoken now in the wake of the July atrocity. But is he right? Or does he instead completely misunderstand the essence of civilised society, the life of the nation? We certainly know that this country faces a grave and possibly unquantifiable threat from those who would spend their lives on the prize of taking many others. Mohammed Khan provides a clear, chilling and public reminder. We fear, and perhaps even expect, that more of our lives will be taken before this particular breed of totalitarianism is defeated. But is the life of the nation equivalent simply to a certain level of risk to a large number of people? Alternatively, does it relate to supplies of water, food, fuel, medicine, and to the functioning of the democratic state itself? I prefer the latter view, not through a lack of care for loss of life, far from it. It simply seems to me that a state of public emergency of indefinite length is as dangerous as the unending war on terror which allows a murderer to call himself a soldier. A limitless state of emergency is a contradiction in terms. It is no longer a temporary departure from the proper and normal order of society for as short a period as possible in order to re-establish the means of existence, government, and law. It is instead a new state of being, a state of constitutional poverty without the ethical framework that we most need in times of greatest difficulty. Loss of the rule of law and the human rights framework would also deprive us of the very inspiration that is the ultimate antidote to the threat. There has, in my view, been far too much public hand-wringing about what it means to be British, what the ties that bind us should or ought to be. I am as certain in my core beliefs as any of those who challenge them, and my values, I would contend, are as British as they are even-handed, as they are universal. those in permanent search of new codes of living would, I think, be well advised to remember those we already have. Surely, there has never been a nobler or more rational system designed by man.
Thank you very much indeed for that very wide-ranging, reflective, and yet also hard-hitting exposition of our current situation. Remains for me now to call on our commentator to address us. We have a commentator. He's just typically modest and is sitting in the audience. Our commentator has unrivaled experience of advocacy with respect to these matters. Sir Sidney Kentridge was born in South Africa, qualifying there as a barrister, dare I say it, in 1949, becoming senior counsel in the 1960s. He later was called to the English bar in the 70s and has practiced here as Queen's Counsel since 1984. For over 50 years then, Sir Sidney has practiced at the bar, gaining a widely acknowledged reputation as one of the truly great advocates of the latter half of the 20th century. We know this because when the bar itself found difficulties with the government and wanted to challenge the government by way of judicial review, the advocate to whom they went was Sir Sidney Kentridge. Truly the barrister's barrister. And throughout this period, Sidney Kentridge's work has involved advocacy with those engaged in questions of security and liberty. He appeared as counsel for the local community at the inquiry into the Sharpeville massacres in the early 1960s, appeared at the treason trials and the trial of Nelson Mandela, represented Stella Madzimba Muto in both the Rhodesian courts, as they then were, and the Privy Council in her challenge against the legality of Ian Smith's regime, and represented the Biko family at the inquest which followed Steve Biko's death. Since practicing at the English bar, Sir Sidney has continued to use this experience, most recently when appearing for an intervener in the torture case, the A No. 2 torture case that Chami mentioned in her address, and also making submissions to the United States Supreme Court in the Guantanamo Bay detainees case. So Sidney has also acted as a judge of the Constitutional Court of South Africa and lectured widely on matters of civil rights, especially in relation to South Africa. We are delighted to welcome and ask Sir Sidney to make comments on.
Mr. Chairman, that was a very generous introduction, rather better than the last one I got, where the chairman said, many of you here have heard Sir Sidney speak before. The rest of you will be looking forward to hearing him this evening. Now, I'm here as a commentator. I want to say in the first place what a splendid survey of this difficult problem we've just had from Shami Chakrabarty, given with her usual lucidity and eloquence. And she's rightly warned us to be vigilant, to scrutinize with care, and where necessary, to protest. And I must say that it is very difficult to disagree with anything that Shami says, but nonetheless, I'll do my best. I've got some doubts, and may I just express them as briefly as I can. I've got doubts about the idea that the threat of terrorism, such as we've had here, can be met by ideological and sociological responses. I do not think that people like Muhammad Siddiqui Khan are susceptible to rational, philosophical, or ethical arguments. And I have doubts also about the validity of the comparisons with Northern Ireland. The violence in Northern Ireland was the product of 300 years or more of sectarian division. And the men of violence in that community obviously had very great support from their own communities, support and sympathy of thousands, if not 10,000s of people. And the only possible solution there was a political one. I do not see how that can be applied in this situation. We are told on all sides that people like Muhammad Khan did not have the support of their communities. Their communities condemned them. Their followers were and are, we are told, few. And it seems to me completely unrealistic to believe that any government will amend its domestic or foreign policy in order to accommodate the views of a few people like Muhammad Khan. Now, there's something else which I'd like to say with great diffidence, and that is that I do think that Sharmi's account of the state of the rule of law in this country was somewhat on the pessimistic side. I really don't think that things are as bad as that. We don't have martial law here. We don't have indefinite detention, executive detention without trial, such as one had in this country in two world wars, and such as one had in South Africa under apartheid. We don't have anything like the United States Patriot Act. We have nothing like Guantanamo Bay. But to get to more detailed aspects of it, Sharmi mentioned the Belmarsh case. That is the case where there was a system whereby aliens who couldn't be deported, who were suspected of terrorism, could be detained indefinitely without trial. Now, I think Sharmi said that that was a discredited policy. But it was more than that. It was a policy which was held to be illegal by the House of Lords and which had to be discontinued. Similarly, with torture, the House of Lords said authoritatively that no evidence obtained by torture could be adduced in any court or tribunal in this country. Now, another point of detail, the government, prompted by the police, tried to introduce a law whereby people suspected of terrorism could be detained by the police for 90 days before they had to be either charged or released. Now, I could hear no justification from any source for the extension of the time to 90 days. But the point is that that government proposal was roundly defeated by legislators of all parties in both houses of parliament. So it's not as though it has become the law, nor is there any suggestion that people in those houses of parliament will change their view or that it will become the law. Freedom of speech. Now, that's rather a difficult one. Glorification of terrorism as an offence or part of an offence. Well, I must say that I've never thought that that was either a useful or necessary addition to the lexicon of criminal offences in this country. It's very difficult to define, but nonetheless, I don't believe that its ramifications are as serious as some have suggested. I just cannot believe that any person in this country will be prosecuted, still less convicted, for saying that Zimbabweans cannot gain their freedom unless Mugabe is overthrown. Nor do I believe that anyone will be prosecuted or convicted for engaging in the classical philosophical arguments about when it is justifiable to overthrow the state by violence. And vague as glorification might be, it will be for the courts to interpret it. And on their record, the courts are likely to give an extremely narrow definition to it. Definition, of course, is often difficult. There's a famous saying by a United States Supreme Court judge who was faced with the question of whether a law outlawing pornography was a valid law. And he said, "I can't define pornography, but I can recognize it when I see it." And some of us who saw some of the placards which were used in that protest outside the Danish embassy a few weeks ago might also say of some of those placards, one had no difficulty in recognizing what they were about. If I may have a half a minute interpolation, the United States Justice's clerk, a very irreverent young fellow, said that what the justice really meant to say was that I can't define pornography, but I can recognize it when I buy it. So I do feel that in general one mustn't be downhearted about this. We're not living in a fascist state. We're not even living in the United States. And I believe that our courts and our legislators will protect us against the sort of excesses which we've seen in some other countries. So, Mr. Chairman, those are my comments. And despite my qualifications, may I again say what a brilliant speech I think that Sharmi made, which should be this will be the starting point in future of any further discussion of this subject.
Well, we have some time left, and therefore I'm going to throw open the issue to the floor. Let me begin by three house rules. One, if you wish to speak, first wait until one of the attendants presents you with a microphone, because otherwise the rest of us will not hear what you have to say. Secondly, please ask a question. Don't give us a speech. Thirdly, can you also identify your name and affiliation if you're going to make a short, direct question? What I'll try to do is to gather in two or three questions before I put it to our panel this evening. Thank you.
Questions?
And fourthly, raise your hand if you want to ask a question.
Or you could go home.
Sorry. This is to Shami. I'm Katie Bach. I'm a master student in global politics. Do you think that the provisions of the criminal code in the UK are completely sufficient to deal with the threat? Or do you think it's a threat of such a new nature that we need to change the criminal law?
Question here at
My name's Marcus, no affiliation, just a member of the public. Do you feel that Britain as a nation is producing men or women wise enough to run Britain as a nation in the modern world?
Small question. You have to recognise the liberty of our panellists not to answer all of the questions as fully as you might wish. Anyone else?
Hello, my name is Aidan. I have no affiliation. I'm a member of the public. Do you think the 90-day legislation that you both referred to was intended as a smokescreen to detract attention from other bills that are going in at the same time?
One more. Upstairs. We got someone with the microphone upstairs? No.
It's all right. William Gallagher, London Metropolitan University. As far as this is for both of the panel. As far as overruling the Human Rights Act, Article 10, it has to be done directly and unambiguously. How does glorification of terrorism fulfil that function of being direct and unambiguous? I've already said tonight that it's extremely vague.
Okay. We probably have enough to be going on with.
Shall I start? Do we need to change the criminal law? There's one change to the criminal law that I think is long overdue, and I'm not alone. And this is one of the few things that the Met Commissioner and I agree about. So it must be, we must be right, or I must be wrong. We ought to admit the use of intercept product. This is the product of telephone taps. We ought to allow the possibility of taped telephone conversations to be used in criminal courts, because it seems to me potentially to be a very good source of it. We talked about how intelligence can sometimes be hardened into something that could be relevant and valuable evidence, reliable evidence. And I just think it's barking, frankly. That's a technical term that we use at Liberty. Probably don't use it in these rarefied academic environments. I think it's barking that we almost uniquely in the democratic world do not allow for the possibility, it doesn't have to be used in every case, the possibility that taped telephone conversations could actually be used in court. So we allowed a situation in this country where people could languish in Belmarsh for X years. And I don't know about the guilt or innocence of those people. You know, I used to work in the Home Office. I don't think that it's all a conspiracy. I hope I've tried to reveal that. It's perfectly possible that some of those people were there languishing in indefinite detention without trial as it was until the law lords rightly stopped it on the basis of incriminating telephone taps. And I don't see why that stuff isn't used in trials. And sometimes it will incriminate and sometimes it will exculpate, and there can be arguments about the technical veracity of that evidence as there are in other cases. We have this bizarre situation where somebody plants a listening device in my car or in my house. The product of my conversations picked up by that listening device can be used in court, potentially, but not if it's a telephone conversation. And that seems ridiculous. I think one really ought to aspire, without corrupting fair trials, and I don't think this would be a problem with the fair trials, to bring people to justice. So that's one change that I would advocate.
Yeah. Would you have said that 10 years ago, Shami?
10 years ago? Yeah, I think I would. What was I doing 10 years ago?
Wow. That is to say, has the climate changed such that we change what we regard as being acceptable in the criminal process?
I don't think there's anything. I don't think even on a very strict and conventional view of fair trials or Article 6 of the Convention, there is a problem with telephone. I used to work in the Home Office, and the received wisdom was that the concerns about doing this came from the intelligence community, not from the human rights community or the civil liberties community, as it would have been called some time ago. The concern was originally that people were just not aware of the technology. They weren't aware of the extent to which telephones could be tapped. But do me a favour, people are over that now. People know that this happens. And so that objection begins to... No, I'm not saying that there aren't some real concerns from certain parts of the services, but I think that really needs to be examined. But they're operational intelligence concerns, such as they are. They are not human rights concerns. From a privacy, like speech, is not an absolute right. And there are few people who would suggest that it isn't appropriate when you're investigating terrorist offences or other serious offences to, for example, allow a judge to issue a warrant to search my home to look for incriminating articles if there's been a proper process and there is suspicion that I'm harbouring explosives or whatever. So if you can get a warrant to search my home, why not a warrant to listen to my phone calls? It happens. It happens now. It just can't. It can't be used, and therefore it can't be used to bring people to justice. So I would do that. Are we producing wise future leaders in Britain? I'm confident we must be. Lots of bright young people joining Liberty. And actually, I do share some of. I do. I have this problem that I always look miserable. And I'm going to do. I am going to. This is the. You know, I always say to people, I am the Grim Reaper. You know, you see me everywhere. You know things are awful, and you know I've got to seem more optimistic. I am actually optimistic, and I agree with a lot of your remarks about optimism. You know, parliamentarians, not just in the Lords, crucially, that 90-day vote was really important, and I take great heart and optimism from it. It wasn't even the House of Lords in its legislative capacity. That big victory happened, was delivered by elected parliamentarians in the House of Commons, people of all parties, people like Dominic Grieve, the Shadow Attorney General, people like Diane Abbott, an old lefty in the Labour Party, all of these people united around that central issue. So of course I think we're capable of producing leaders. I think all Democrats can unite about some of these values. Was the 90-day thing a smokescreen for other, this is always a potential. This is a real concern. I do know that when I worked on legislation in the Dark Tower, in the Home Office. Sorry, it's not in a dark tower anymore. They've got a lovely new. Since I left, they've got a lovely sort of multicoloured, friendly building. But they used to be in Queen Anne's Gate. I used to call it the concrete monstrosity. We used to sometimes tactically, when we worked on legislation, have something really awful that you knew you would give up as a concession in at the committee stage of a bill. You know, there is a certain, there is tactics that goes on here. I think there was some tactics, but I think actually the tactics may have been from the police, who thought, this is a moment. ACPO is effectively a lobbying organisation for the police that has enormous influence, particularly in relation to Home Office policy. It's the chief constable's lobby group. It's not, in my view, a serious policy-making body at all. I've had some dealings with them from inside and outside government. I think they thought the time is right to have a go at various things that we want. And 90 days went in. Think of a number, any number. It's currently 14. Let's have a good old go. We'll never get exactly what we want, so we'll put in 90 days. And do you know what? I think if the Home Secretary, Charles Clarke, had his way from the start, they would have... You know, 90 days wouldn't have even been offered up in the bill. I think that then the Prime Minister came back from his holidays and the rules of the game changed. And I think he thought, to hell with it. Like, you know, people have written about this endlessly in the newspapers and speculated on whether it was always intended that there were... I don't think it was. I think there was a bit of bartering. But the trouble is, that's what happens when you don't have a governing principle. When you say, let's think of a number and... somewhere between 14 and what, and then we'll split the difference. That's what I think happened with 90 days. And glorification is ridiculously broad. But as I tried to suggest, and perhaps didn't do so clear, I think glorification is a bit of a red herring. I know that the House of Lords, in its legislative capacity, has got very excited about glorification. It's caught the political media's imagination. But glorification now is just really there in the offence as an example of one of the ways in which you can encourage terrorism. And I do accept that it might be possible to glorify terrorism, including 7th of July terrorism, in a way that one could properly describe as inciting murder. You know, these men were the Fantastic Four and we should all seek to emulate them immediately. You can go down a road where that actually, that glorification, if you want to call it that, does, in context, produce a proper offence of intentionally inciting people to murder. My problem is therefore not really with the glorification at all. My problem is with a reckless intent speech offence called encouraging terrorism, where terrorism is so ridiculously broadly defined. And I hear what Sir Sidney said about we're all good chaps and this is England and Shammy, this won't be used against you. I say two things about that. Firstly, with a speech offence, you don't need to worry just about convictions or even prosecutions. You need to worry about this chilling effect of what people... You know, poor old Iqbal Soekarni, who's done a bit of lobbying for overbroad speech offences in his time, made some homophobic remarks on the radio, and the police were investigating him for an old overbroad offence called threatening and abusive language. You know, this does produce a certain chilling effect on the nature of a free society. And the second point I make is, one has to, this is constitutional stuff, and one should look to the future, not just to this wonderful moment where we're all good chaps. You do have to, when you put this stuff on the statute book, care about how it could be used or abused by accident or design in 10 or 15 or 20 years' time. I don't think anybody thought when Section 44 of the Terrorism Act was passed, this broad stop and search power that the House of Lords has upheld today, I'm disappointed to say, that poor old Walter Wolfgang would have been carted out of the Labour Party convention and detained under it.
I concur and have nothing to add.
And unusually nothing to say either.
Right, I think I'd probably better call this evening's proceedings to a close. Since both of our speakers have talked about optimism, let me end on an optimistic note with giving you two facts you probably don't know about either of the speakers. First, Sir Sidney's had many important cases, but none more important than when he appeared for William Shakespeare in an action disputing his authorship before the Middle Temple Hall. And secondly, when he appeared for the government of His Majesty George III against George Washington in a treason trial. I think the jury's still out on both those matters, notwithstanding Sir Sidney's advocacy in both those cases. As to Shammy, well, there are not many lawyers in the world who have had a pop group record a tribute signal called in their name. Shammy Chakrabarty apparently is a recorded tribute single of a group called, world famous group called The Dastards. Go out and buy it, and no doubt it's a wonderful piece of work. And secondly, more seriously, I hope I'm the first to make the announcement that Shammy has just been appointed to the Court of Governors of the LSE, and therefore technically is my employer, and therefore I hope you will all give her a wonderful, warm round of applause for such a wonderful address this evening.